طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. As promised, we are returning to our coverage of the annual revelatory conference on the Israeli lobby, sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, which was held in Washington, D.C. in early March of 2018. Exposing the machinations of the lobby, especially AIPAC, and its inordinate influence over the U.S. President and Congress, is crucial to exposing the distortions and lies of the lobby, which have controlled American opinion on the Israel-Palestine issue for decades. This morning we hear back-to-back presentations by Professor Virginia Tilley and UN Specialist Ian Williams. Each presentation begins with an introduction.
I'm Janet McMahon, Managing Editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And since April 5th, 1982, when we published our first issue, we have been covering all the activities of AIPAC and the Greater Israel Lobby. So it's great to see such a wonderful turnout for our fifth conference on the Israel lobby. And as you all know, there's a very strong wind outside today. And thank you for braving that wind. And it's a wind that I do think is blowing in our direction. So as a result of last century's two world wars, the majority of the world's countries committed themselves to the principle of international law, which was embodied in the United Nations. But adherence to that principle and to the institution has not been guaranteed, and in some cases has been outright undermined. Our first speaker, Dr. Virginia Tilley, is a professor of political science at Southern Illinois University. She earned her MA and PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and an MA from Georgetown's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. She has conducted research in Central America, Israel-Palestine, post-apartheid South Africa, and Oceania. She is the author of The One-State Solution, A Pragmatic Analysis of the Two-State Solution in Israel-Palestine, and editor of Beyond Occupation, Apartheid, Colonialism, and International Law in the Occupied Palestinian Territories. Dr. Tilley is also the co-author with Professor Richard Falk of a 2017 report commissioned by the UN's Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia titled Israeli Practices Towards the Palestinian People and the Question of Apartheid. Despite intense pressure from Israel and the U.S., the commission's chair, Reem Khalif, refused to withdraw the report and resigned in protest. The UN subsequently deleted the report from its website. Fortunately, however, we are about to benefit from the expertise which informed that report's findings. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Virginia Tilley.
Thank you very much. It's a distinct privilege to be here, especially in the somewhat daunting position of first speaker. I have to set the tone. In this presentation, I'm not actually going to talk too much about the findings of the report. We really did write that report for a broad, informed audience of concerned people, and it is not hard to read, I think. You don't have to be a legal scholar to do it. So I'm going to briefly summarize the report itself and then talk about what I think is much more engaging at this point to me, which is the implications of the report, implications for diplomacy and conflict resolution in Israel-Palestine. So I was asked first to address the question of, is the U.S. supporting an apartheid state in Israel-Palestine? Well, yes, it is, in short. It is an apartheid state. And by the way, there is no such thing in international law as apartheid state, but its practices are consistent with apartheid, and I'll come to that in a moment. But the deeper answer here is yes, and so are a lot of other people, including people who wouldn't think they are. And that's what I wanted to come to in regard to the implications of this finding for questions such as the two-state solution. Essentially, those seeking partition are endorsing an apartheid state, and that is a bit startling, so I want to get to that. And it raises this dilemma that if apartheid anywhere is inadmissible and destabilizing, it cannot comprise the basis for a just and stable peace. Now, this lifts us out of a question of whether you're pro-anybody, and simply if you're concerned about international peace and security, which apartheid is considered to be a threat to. So in this talk, again, I'm going to talk briefly about the analysis, the legal definition of apartheid, how it works, and why it requires Israel to sustain the occupation. This is a particular point I'd like to bring forth here, and then move on to the implications and why it brings us directly to the question of reunification as the only viable mode of conflict resolution. So it is based on three sources. The first is my own book that I wrote narrowly on the question of whether Israel could be expected to withdraw from the occupied territories to allow a two-state solution. The second one was this really extraordinary experience of coordinating a team of international lawyers. I'm a political scientist, not an international lawyer, through a project supported by the South African government. I believe this is on the desk out there. It is a legal analysis. Any of you who are familiar with international law should find it rewarding. Others of you might find it a bit dense. And the third one, of course, is this wonderful experience I had, a privilege of working with Dr. Richard Falk on the UN report, which was mentioned already. And a lot of what I'm going to say here came out of that report, but a lot of what's in that report relied on the previous one, Beyond Occupation. So the deeper legal analysis for the UN report is to be found there. So what is apartheid? We, very briefly, the report gets into this in detail. We use apartheid very broadly. Anything that sort of strikes us as racist or segregationist maybe elicit this term. That's perfectly fine as far as I'm concerned. We use terms anyway that are suggestive or useful for a particular analysis. But if we're going to argue that states are accountable under international law to act to end apartheid, then we must refer to the law which prescribes that obligation. That means we are brought to the relevant international law, and that is found in two major instruments, the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid and the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. The first definition is far larger, much more detailed, but it lists a series of acts, including segregation and reserves that I'll come to. But it says that these are only acts of apartheid under certain conditions. They have to fit certain overarching conditions. And those conditions include, they may be similar to practices in South Africa. This is a universal instrument. They do not have to be exactly the same. The point is whether they seek, they have these other qualities of the law, that they are, that these are acts committed for the purpose of establishing and maintaining domination. That I call that the purpose clause. And that it involves racial groups, that and a systematic system of oppression, it is not just a random collection of discrete laws, but a comprehensive institutionalized system that distinguishes the apartheid, and the Rome Statute picks up on that by emphasizing, bringing in a new term, which is institutionalized regime. Political scientists get all flushed with pleasure when you talk about regimes because we have loads of theory about regimes. We start to feel a little bit more on familiar land. All these elements of the definition are satisfied in this case. The report, I refer you to the report on this. It is an institutionalized regime. It's a comprehensive system of laws that ensures Jewish national privileges. And I want to stress that hyphenated construction here. The idea that Jews are a nation and that as a people or a nation that they have this certain privileges. That it does include policies similar to South Africa, but any policy variation there would not disqualify them necessarily, but it's nonetheless quite suggestive that they do. It is a racial conflict according to international law, defining what is racial discrimination, which includes groups defined by descent. And in this case, the local construction of Jewishness and Palestinianness or Arabness is descent groups. The key quality here, which conveys special privileges to one group over another, is postulations about their descent and therefore their rights to the land dating from antiquity. Expressed particularly in the Declaration of the Establishment of the State of Israel, which has the status of constitutional law and Israeli law. I'm speaking kind of fast here about law, so if you're getting a little like the wind outside, it's not to worry. It's clarified in the report. And crucially, the purpose clause is satisfied, that there is this aim, this formal aim, to maintain Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. We have a cluster of laws and policies on the books to look at to confirm that Israel has that purpose, if anyone was in doubt about it. So from a legal perspective, that is satisfied as well. What was more interesting to me when figuring out what how Israel was pursuing its apartheid regime was the way it works, which is these crucial policy variations among four interwoven regimes and by the domain, which domain referring here to a territorial geographic entity and a cluster of expectations, norms, rules, practices within that geographically defined ambit. The first domain being Palestinian citizens of Israel. Now, what matters here most is the right to vote, because if you're going to have Jewish and democratic state, then it becomes important not to allow non-Jews to vote those laws out. That means that you have to constrain the vote. You can allow people to vote, but you can't allow them to vote on that point. And in order to do that, you have to make sure that the non-Jewish vote is never large enough to threaten those laws. So Palestinian citizens of Israel famously do have the vote, which is often cited as the crucial difference with South Africa, but they are not allowed to vote against their own minority status. They are not allowed to vote against the Jewish national character of Israel. Palestinian residents of Jerusalem, about 300,000 people, have no national vote. They can vote for the municipal government, but not for the national government, so they are carefully excised from that potential body of voters who could challenge the Jewish national character of Israel. Palestinians in the occupied territories, of course, have no vote. They are not citizens. And they can vote for the Palestinian Authority under the terms of Oslo, but they are carefully sequestered. 5+ million people are carefully pushed out of any possibility of joining an electoral bloc that could challenge this state. And Domain 4 is the Palestinian refugees outside of the country, which outside of the territory under Israeli control, which is clearly, obviously, they don't have the vote. So another way to think of this is as a system. One regime that is effectively composed of four tailored sets of laws covering each population to achieve the same goal, which is to ensure that Israel remains a Jewish and democratic state. All kinds of arguments about whether you can be a Jewish and democratic state or a white and democratic state, I recognize that, but we don't have time to get into that now. What I would like to stress here is that this system requires that Israel maintain the occupation. Because if Israel does not keep the occupied territories under belligerent occupation, under military occupation, it faces the twin threat that a truly sovereign Palestinian state could form in those territories, which would then threaten Israel's capacity to prevent population mixing. Population mixing is the death knell for any racial state because the neat division of populations begins to go away. When you have people mixing, they make babies and it all falls down. On the other hand, annexation or full integration would require providing citizenship to the Palestinians, so that cannot be allowed either. Current talk about annexation is reflecting that dilemma, but it's better for Israel not to annex it. So what is the solution? Well, military occupation. So people say, well, we have to solve, we must put apartheid to one side in order to look at the occupation. I think you have that the other way around. One is the logic of occupation is following the logic of apartheid. So speeding right along, part two, implications for diplomacy. If apartheid, as it always does, it destabilizes the whole region, threatens international peace and security, it must be stopped on those grounds alone. It is morally untenable. It's a crime against humanity. It must be stopped. But how? The vision of two states is fatally flawed. My first book on the one-state solution got into this in some detail. Just from a pragmatic point of view, I really only addressed that one thing. And what it does mean that we cannot anticipate that Israel will withdraw. It's become emperor's new clothes kind of fantasy to think that that will happen. I don't think that's acceptable anymore. It requires a great deal of defense, and it fails. Sustaining Jewish statehood on the part of the territory, this is the crucial thing. If you partition the land in order to allow Israel to remain Israel in one part of it and a Palestinian state to form in the other part of it, you are basically saying apartheid will continue in that part where Israel is now composed. Saying Israel will continue to be a Jewish and democratic state, it will continue to operate the way it is operating, it will continue to be apartheid regime in a slightly different, modified border, within different borders. Now, let's my thought experiment, transplant that I did in South Africa. It would have been okay for white South Africans to sustain apartheid in part of the country and turn over the rest of it to black South Africans. No one entertained such an idea. It was anathema. This is the same thing here. You can't end apartheid by dividing the land and allowing it to continue in another part of the land. There's other aspects of this, but cutting to the chase, I would propose, therefore, that reunification is the only way to end apartheid. And since there's so many reasons to do that, we have to take that very seriously. For activism, and by activism I mean every kind of activism from grassroots to legal activism and diplomatic activity and so forth. If you're going to, and I just wanted to focus again on this angle of end the occupation. End the occupation is a mantra, it's a slogan, it's a sign people carry in marches. It's also a legal argument. But how? Again, Israel's withdrawal from the OPT cannot be anticipated. At best, it would be very partial. This is the Olmert plan, by the way, that you're looking at up here, where all the yellow would be Israel and the white would be Palestine, with a little umbilicus between the West Bank and Gaza. I mean, this is obviously an unviable state building. You couldn't control water, you couldn't control agriculture, you can't build a road that connects them, you can't, you know, it's unworkable. Would not end apartheid. Establish a state of Palestine to leverage withdrawal. Now, this is a very popular movement right now, big diplomatic push in the United Nations to do this. However, my point here is that if we accept the apartheid analysis that this is an apartheid regime, then such a state would be a Bantustan. It would lack the attributions of true sovereignty. Israel, as long as it is composed as an apartheid regime, cannot accept any Palestinian state that is not a Bantustan. because any truly sovereign state would threaten the Jewish national character of Israel. This means that a Bantustan state, a state of Palestine formed under these conditions, would only secure Palestinian poverty, underdevelopment, frustration, insecurity, and essentially sustain the conflict itself. I'd like to just take an extra moment here, and I'm going to destroy my time constraint, I hope not, but I will pray that a little bit of extra attention to the Bantustans is worthwhile, and I frankly encourage everyone here to Google that and spend 15 minutes looking at the Bantustans a bit more than we sometimes do. I went to South Africa to study this material because I realized I didn't understand it, and I found it fascinating as a comparison to the Palestinian Authority and the territorial and institutional constraints that it's operating under. Let's just think through the logic. Apartheid imperative, the imperative of apartheid, wherever it would appear, would be to prevent racial mixing. Okay. Otherwise, the whole logic begins to fall apart. If you can't discreetly have different populations, there's nothing to defend. In order to do that, you need strict geographic segregation. This requires that you, if you're going to actually make this work, you need separate authorities within these territories. The South Africans, interestingly, called them black self-government authorities. And guess what Oslo called them? Palestinian self-government authority. It's a great deal of conversations between Israel and South Africa about the Bantustans. It took a lot of lessons from it. I learned that from the diplomats in South Africa, by the way. This channels Palestinian or black or indigenous political aspirations to the local authority rather than to the state, to the dominant state. It's very convenient for an apartheid state to displace the frustrations and ambitions and the quest for rights of the population is dominating to their own leadership, operating under very tight constraints, of course. The pictures you're looking at on the top is a lineup of the Bantustan leaders in South Africa in the Bantustans, but nine of these leaders were in this picture. And below the Palestinian Authority. And by the way, I don't mean to impugn the integrity or you know, political will of any of the Palestinian Authority people. My point here is a structural one, that they are put into a position where they are compelled to act like a Bantustan authority. And point of view of the dominant state, the main function of this authority is to repress dissent, which in the top picture you see the Bantustan armed forces, in the lower part you see the Palestinian armed forces doing exactly that, maintaining the Bantustan through proxy measures. And we don't have time to get into this. I wrote a separate article about this, though, because I found it fascinating. The Oslo Accords established the Palestinian Authority on terms almost identical to the South African Bantustan constitutions, blow by blow. If you put those next to each other, you find almost exactly the same arrangements. And it's interesting that the ANC perceived this as a trap, rejected it from the beginning, and refused to have anything to do with it. And in fact, I understand Nelson Mandela told Arafat, bad idea, don't go for this, this is not a good idea, and they went for it anyway. So, in short, the PIA is now locked into being this self-government authority, and it cannot act independently of that role. The alternative, therefore, is if the partition can only sustain apartheid, and we must rethink the conflict on using South Africa not as a model but as inspiration or a kind of a thought experiment. They called it colonialism of a special type. It doesn't involve agreeing and admitting that a large population of people has come in and indigenized, settled, is not going to go away. Call it settler colonialism, shift the model from a colonial to a settler colonial model. And that means that you do not end it by partition you can't end settler colonialism and its power by partition. You have to end it by eliminating settler domination. Treating Palestine as a multinational state is on the basis of race would only perpetuate a settler discourse, because it is Zionism that has proposed that there are these identities that then if you recognize them and institutionalize them, you're essentially perpetuating apartheid. Treat the whole country as one country, Palestine, wrongly divided by race. This was the South Africa formula. It's one country wrongly divided by race. This means reunifying mandate Palestine. I'm out of time, aren't I? How am I doing? Okay. There is a legal basis for doing this. If we turn back to the League of Nations mandate, it always proposed that it was one country for everyone who lived there. That it would not be a Jewish state or anybody's state. It would be a secular democratic state. So there's a nice, fat, legal argument to explore there. The hard part of this is that reunification does raise very serious questions of identity shifts to reconstruct the idea of the nation, reconstruct the idea of the groups. In this case, Palestine would stop being a foggy mandate reference or a dreamy future, but it would be one state that belongs to all who live in it. It would not be the exclusive geographic heritage of any one part of the population. It would not require the departure or exclusion of anybody, which is tough for people who have lost a great deal to it. Jewish has to be reconceived as an ethnic group with full civil, social, and cultural rights, not a people with superior rights to the land, not as a nation with rights to self-determination. And Palestinian, this is the toughest thing for me to say as a non-Palestinian, but it returning to the idea that it is a multi-sectarian identity, it still is actually, embracing everyone in mandate territory, not Arab in any sense that would exclude non-Arabs. Okay, this is one of the problems that Palestinian became Palestinian-Arab state. And under conditions of settler colonialism, you can't do that without excluding non-Arabs, and therefore, unfortunately, that has to be rethought deeply. Not the racial ethnic construction affirmed by Zionism and imposed by apartheid. So that's why the apartheid finding recasts everything. That's why so many people don't want to tackle it. I think it is crucial. I think it illuminates where we are and what is going on, and the more I look at it, the more powerful an analysis I think it is, and I do hope you will consider it seriously as a model for rethinking the conflict. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker, Ian Williams, is a native of Liverpool, England, and has been the Washington Report's UN correspondent since 1991. So it's no surprise that he really knows the ins and outs of that world body. He has twice served as president of the UN Correspondents Association and has won many awards for his exposés of UN malfeasance. At the same time, he has supported and defended the UN and its ideals and has personally known four secretaries general, as well as numerous international diplomats and officials. Ian has been a columnist for The Nation and The Guardian American Online and an editor for the World Policy Journal. A senior analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus, he is the author of The UN for Beginners and the recently published Untold, The Real Story of the United Nations in Peace and War. And he and Dr. Tilley will be signing their books during the break that follows this panel. Please join me in welcoming Ian Williams.
It'd be difficult to follow Virginia's detailed academic expose, but it's worth remembering, one of the big problems with the United Nations is people, what's it good for? And, I'm pretty diffident about this. I tell people it's the worst possible organization except all the alternatives. And it does work that way. If you start off with a sense of realism about what the United Nations can do, what it stands for, then you don't get disappointed too easily, and you welcome its small successes. And there are successes, and they're very relevant here. And there's a very good reason why Israel and its lobby concentrate so much on the United Nations. What Kofi Annan called the unique legitimizing power of the United Nations We've seen several results of this recently. And Israel can never get clear title of Jerusalem or the occupied territories without a UN say-so. That's key. And it's actually been proven since 1945. If you think of the occupations, East Timor, everyone had given up on East Timor. The Indonesians, I actually told the foreign minister over lunch one day, you'll never get clear title, ever, until you can get the UN to do it, and the UN won't. So they fought it to a standstill in there, but in the end, East Timor is independent. Only this week, and I don't know whether you saw this, the European Court of Justice actually ruled that the European Union had no right to sign fishing treaties with Morocco that included Western Saharan fisheries. In effect, the European Court was legitimizing boycotts of produce from occupied territories. I think that one is something that should be played up a lot more. Yeah, because I know it's a contentious subject, but we've pointed out several times in Washington Report that there's a separation wall in Western Sahara as well as in Palestine, that there are many parallels there. The other one, of course, is Western Sahara will, in fact, sometime, even you never see a map where it's included in Morocco. The Moroccans cannot get clear title. And it's the same with the occupied territories and Jerusalem. And this brings us back to the ambivalence of Israel and the lobby. They have, I mean, how should I put this? It's almost psychological, psychoanalysis. They have a deep respect for law. But in a sort of the Talmudic way that makes the elevator stop on every floor in the Sabbath so they can still take the elevator and obey the letter. Israel spends a lot of time trying to work its way around the laws. It very rarely completely denies them. So at the United Nations, they and the US spend a lot of time trying to create the sort of Sabbath elevator so that they can skirt within the law. But they are very scared of actual definitions of the law. That's why they are so upset. If the UN were ineffectual, they wouldn't devote so much effort to thwarting resolutions in there. And take Virginia's object. There is an apartheid convention. And it's like the genocide convention. There is a legal international binding commitment on member states to do something about an apartheid state. If Israel is declared to be an apartheid state or practicing apartheid, there are legal consequences that states have to follow. In another regard, if you remember Jim Baker in Bosnia and the State Department were very, very solicitous to make sure the word genocide never appeared. You know, mass murder was fine. Mass murder is something that you can ignore. Genocide has a binding legal commitment under the Genocide Convention. You have to do something about it. So, you know, it looks like we're playing with words, but this is very, very serious. And the Israelis know that. For a start, they deny it, but in effect, Israel is the only state that was actually created by a UN resolution. So you have the conundrum that they have been busily denying the efficacy of the United Nations, its legitimacy, saying that the resolutions don't apply. But their very existence depends on a resolution. You hear continually a theme that General Assembly resolutions aren't binding. And we could say, amen, because it was a General Assembly resolution that partitioned Palestine and set up the Israeli state. So, you can see you could have a whole joint conclave of Jesuits and Talmud scholars to work your way out of this particular fine print, you know, where you're denying the basis for your own existence. And it does have international complications because the United States was a founding member of the United Nations. It's still an indispensable part of the United Nations. It's inconceivable that the United Nations would exist without the United States taking part in it. And this creates severe problems because there's always the Israeli exception. Almost every law that comes, every resolution that comes up is being weighed in the balance. Nuclear non-proliferation, we saw with Grant's presentation earlier. The United States is signatory to non-proliferation treaties that say that no country apart from the five permanent members should have nuclear weapons. And then it condones nuclear weapons in Israel. And because it does that, every other country in the world India, Pakistan, North Korea say, hey, if them, why not us? You're continually creating exceptions to your own rules that other people walk in through. You know, the settlements in particular, the US has never actually approved them, but they've changed the language so often over the years that it's as far as the US is concerned, Jerusalem is international territory, the State Department. I believe, just showing this punctiliousness about law, I think I read earlier this year that the State Department is still refusing to issue passports with Jerusalem, Israel, to Americans born there. It's still Jerusalem. They won't put Israel on there. So the State Department does have some residual respect for international law that's missing from the White House completely. So let's get these territories together, because the UN is like... the UN is a sort of cockpit for all of these things. All human life is there. You're watching it. And you have this ambivalent attitude, is most American Jews, as we know, are liberal globalists. They support democracy and freedom. They like the United Nations. They made an exception because of all this stuff about Israel and Zionism as racism. They didn't think it through, but you know, it eroded the support. And this helped erode the support for the United Nations inside the US. So the people who would automatically have been natural supporters of the UN were always ambivalent about it. You have Jewish senators from New York looking over their shoulders who will pass resolutions condemning the UN, cutting the funds. And that's one of the points that the lobby has been doing in Washington, is to try to trim the UN to size by threatening to withhold funds or actually withholding funds or pulling out of organizations, as we've seen recently. And the effect of this isn't just financial. It is a continual sort of attrition of the morale and standing in the UN. We've seen secretary generals now who realize that to get on with the US, you have to pander to the Israel lobby. And all secretary generals have done this to some extent in a pragmatic political way. Kofi Annan was possibly the most accommodating up till then. Ban Ki-moon had a continual stream of the Jewish lobby organizations, B'nai B'rith, Conference of Presidents, they were coming into his office all of the time. He always received them. They were banging on the door. They were also in the UN, and they were banging on the doors of embassies. All of these funny swing states that you sort of, the microstates that only stamp collectors know about usually, will come up to support the US and Israel on these crucial resolutions. You know, the 2, 3, 6, the Pacific Trust territories, a few others, they come there. And this is a result of intensive lobbying by the Israel lobby here on these states to affect Israeli policy. At the moment, we have a particular situation coming, it would be almost laughable, except it's so serious. I don't know whether you know, but Israel is actually running for a seat on the Security Council this year. And, you know, on the face of it, this is laughable, but we have to remember that Morocco was on the Security Council while occupying Western Sahara. Indonesia was on the Security Council while it was occupying East Timor. Rwanda was on the Security Council while it was massacring its own population. You know, so it's not totally unprecedented. But usually they didn't actually say they're defying the whole gamut of international law openly. And is this likely to happen? I don't know. I don't want to get too much into it. But they're running for seat in the West European and Other group, which is an imperial sort of hangover, because essentially it is Europe plus the white Commonwealth, Australia, New Zealand and Canada, plus the US as a sort of ancillary member. And the Asians wouldn't have them. The Africans wouldn't have them. So in the end, intense lobbying by the lobby through the US came in and badgered the Europeans into accepting Israel as a sort of associate member so it could run for offices, which run on a rotatory basis. So Israel became a vice president of the General Assembly, became chairman of obscure committees. Would you believe the Israeli ambassador, I think, is chairman of the legal subcommittee at the moment, which is, it's like putting Casanova in charge of the chastity committee. does not compute. But this Israeli ambassador is actually very, very concerned about this bid. Then this was upgraded very quietly so that Israel became a full member. So it was allowed to run for this, it could run for the Security Council. And the mechanics of this is, regrettably, I mean, it's good for Western Europe, but most of the countries, the Security Council seats rotate on a Buggins' turn basis. You know, they have calendars going decades ahead sometimes of who occupies what position at the UN, which is why you get genocides in the Human Rights Committee, and now you might get Israel on the Security Council. And the reason for that is West Europe is the only one that actually has elections. And if they don't decide within their own group, then it goes to a general poll of all the members to who becomes a temporary member of the Security Council. So Germany and Belgium are the current candidates, and Israel is running against them. And I've been trying to sort of calculate the odds on this. It's difficult. I can imagine there are Israeli ambassadors, the Israeli diplomats going into Berlin and saying, you owe us so much. Why don't you do the right thing? Why don't you stand down and let us run? How could you deny us? Do you want to compound your crimes? And the Germans will say, well, we'll give you another submarine. Shut up. We're taking this one, I suspect. But I am worried about Belgium. The other people will gang up on Belgium and say, you should stand down and do the right thing. Because that's the only way to get in. If it goes to an open poll, Israel isn't going to get it. But if it's done with a stitch-up like this, if Belgium is leaned upon sufficiently by the other powers, it might just do it. So it's worth watching and it's worth intervening. What's the practical effect? A lot. You know, discussions in the Security Council, they do end up crucial. The resolutions that come through, even a temporary member in there can have considerable effect. You know, while France was grandstanding over the Iraq War, it was the other smaller countries with the respect for international law, like Jamaica and Ireland and others like that, who actually provided the bulk of the opposition to the Iraq War in there and stood their ground. Where do we get to with this ambassador? And I think this is where it brings the lobby in as well. Because the UN is so unpopular in some parts of America, like the evangelical Christians, or with the diehard Zionists, it's a great fundraising gamut. I keep getting letters from various organizations saying, poor little Israel, the only country not allowed to be on the Security Council. Poor little Israel, continually victimized at the United Nations, send a check. And I think it's one of the dynamics, I think Grant touched on it before, is these organizations are businesses. They're self-sustaining businesses, so they want checks off people. And if they can find an issue at the United Nations, they can raise money on the strength of it, and they do. But then it has a practical effect, because secretary generals, UN staff get pilloried, they get harassed to do the right thing. And we've seen that with the reports that have been squashed. You know, they'll just get dropped, or they'll be sidelined. I mean, look what happened to poor Arthur Goldstone. Now, he was personally harried into the ground until he gave up. I felt he was almost a tragic figure by the end because he started off with such integrity. But with the US, it's even worse because it destroys the whole basis of the United Nations. The embassy move is in direct defiance of the UN Charter. The US, the founder and drafter of the UN Charter. When the UN Charter was flown from San Francisco to Washington, the case had its own parachute. Al-Jahis, who was carrying the case, didn't have a parachute. I think maybe they knew something or suspected something. But, I mean, that was how seriously the US took the UN at the time. And this is setting at naught international law. I mean, it's been defied, but this is the significance of it. Donald Trump has basically ripped up the UN Charter. And then because we're talking about people who can believe three impossible things before breakfast, like the Red Queen in Alice, they are now saying, but Iran is in defiance of UN resolutions. Therefore, we must take action against it. Because that's the other fulcrum at the moment. The case for a war against Iran is being made in the United Nations. Our current ambassador, Nikki Haley, there, is, I mean, she should get her credentials from Tel Aviv. Not Jerusalem. Because I've never heard her say anything that isn't 150% in support of Israel. She really is. I mean, she's devoted her full time there, and she gets there and pledges in. It gets down to the actual reason why the lobby is so important for these people. You want power in Washington, it goes through the lobby. You want to be president in the United States, as the U.S. ambassador to the UN most assuredly does, you go through the lobby. They will jump through any hoops at all to do it. And that risks they risk the organization, which for all its faults, it's a major but pragmatic conclusion. You may look at the UN and say it's a failure, but as people in there will tell you, we haven't had World War III yet. And that's the measure. But this is the road to World War III. If you dissolve the whole structure of international global law and security, that's where we're going. And that's what Donald Trump has started, and he's done it on behalf of the lobby in there. He's done it because all across this country, people are writing checks to congressmen, persuading them to vote in defiance of international law and to vote to revile the United Nations. There are refugees who will be going very, very hungry all across the Middle East soon because Donald Trump has defunded UNRWA, which, by the way, has been doing the Israelis a favor. They've been very ambivalent. They like to revile it to keep it off balance. But you have to remember that UNRWA has been doing what Israel should have been doing as the occupying power. UNRWA has been paying for the health and education of occupied Palestinians when the occupying power should have been doing it under the Geneva Convention. So the Israelis have known this all along, and they've reviled and shouted about UNRWA, but only so far. I think they are privately probably appalled that Trump has actually followed through on their bluff and cut the funding. No, no, we didn't mean it, Mr. President. We want the money, honestly. We just want to keep them under control. So they have kept them under control to a large extent. They've kept Secretary General after Secretary General under control to some extent. But it still comes back to it. Ban Ki-moon had all of these people from all of the Israeli organizations coming in. But he always, once he'd been to Gaza and saw what was happening in Gaza, that was the key. The Israelis tried to stop him going to Gaza. As soon as he got there, you see all of his statements, he stated very clearly the UN positions about occupation, about Gaza. And so, yes, he kept receiving them, but then he would tell them, you've got to break the siege. You cannot keep on doing this. You've got to end the occupation. And Guterres is in the same position. He's instinctively pro-Israeli, like a lot of European social democrats. But he is now telling them, gently, you've got to. But the terrible thing is, as long as the US is 100% behind Israel, and as long as the lobby keeps it that way, then the UN is never going to be a functioning international body in a complete way, which is bad news for the world, all of us, on every level. You know, whether it's climate change or whatever. It is an indispensable organization, and I see I've entered the red light district now. So I'd better wind up. I always stay in the red light district if I can, but I'll go and sit down. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Professor Virginia Tilley and UN Specialist Ian Williams speaking at the 5th Annual Conference on the Israeli Lobby, sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. All our past programs are there. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.